Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:24 PM, the Pacific Summer Time. Today is May 7th, and because there's a bank holiday in the UK tomorrow, I am recording the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes today. And the next time, comment of the day and the subscribers' audio and video is going to be updated will be on Monday. Now, I thought I would kick off today and look at the total assets of the big central banks when they're redenominated into US dollars, because there's been two massive accelerations in the course of the last 12 years. The first was back in 2008, where we had very substantial monetary assistance. What I find particularly interesting is the way that this is being reported today. A lot of people are saying that it wasn't really until into 2009 that the Federal Reserve engaged in quantitative easing, and that's just simply not true. They massively increased the supply of dollars right at the end of the end of September 2008, and the market hit a meaningful low in October. It didn't stop going down, however, but the pace of the decline moderated substantially, and then we had the low come in March of 2009. Everyone at that stage was still worried about the second shoe dropping, and that there was going to be an additional crisis, that everything was going to get worse from there. But then the monetary assistance that was being provided continued to increase. And it does take time for, and it does take approximately 6 months for monetary easing to finally find its way into the real economy. Well, we have had $4 trillion printed on a global basis over the course of the last 2 months. And it generally takes about 6 months to really kick into the economy. So it is reasonable to anticipate that by the time we get into the second half of the third quarter, that we should start to see some of that filtering through into economic statistics in the real economy. Now, we've had $4 trillion printed, and this is raising a number of questions. I think these are big long-term questions which are appropriate to really tackle in this forum. Well, the first is, of course, how on earth are governments going to pay for all of this? This massive increase in the supply of cash is obviously money coming out of nowhere, and there are going to be repercussions down the road. The second question is it over? Is $4 trillion all that we're going to see, or is this total going to continue to increase? Well, I think that we can assume, and markets are certainly assuming already, that the quantity of money is going to continue to increase. And that when we simply look at the tabling of monetary assistance that the Federal Reserve has already said they're going to provide, then the size of their balance sheet is now up to $6.6 trillion, which is well in excess of what it was previously at the previous peak. It's also indicative of massively more assistance coming out of the Federal Reserve than other central banks. But $6.6 trillion is really only the starting blocks, and that there is clear potential that it is going to go much higher from here. So that is representative of a very significant additional stimulus that is coming down the line. Now, obviously, people have to start thinking about, well, are we going to move into another period of austerity, similar to what we did after the massive monetary assistance in 2008, or are we in a different environment? Well, one thing that is very clear is that austerity is really grim. It's deflationary in fact. It clearly tries to just pay down the debts with current abilities to pay. So then there is no room for growth. There is nothing left over to invest in future potential. And over time, that is sharply deflationary. It is terrible for sentiment when people feel like they have a weight just tied around their necks that they simply cannot move. And it gives rise to revolutionary movements. And we've had plenty of that in the last few years. The one thing that has been truly, or has been a clear symptom of austerity, has been the rise of revolutionary populist movements, whether that is from the left wing or the right wing. They have arisen everywhere. It started off with Modi in India and spread to Europe with a number of elections in Europe giving up either upstart populist movements gaining more seats than anyone ever thought possible, whether that is far right parties, far left parties, or completely populist new parties, whether it is the success Brexit revolution in pushing the question to the people, which would never really have happened previously, whether it therefore is then the success of President Trump in winning the election in 2016, or Bolsonaro winning the election in Brazil, or from the right wing side, or AMLO winning the election in Mexico from the left wing side. Every single one of these is a direct response to the loss of purchasing power, the loss of true growth potential for regular people rather than the moneyed classes. And this widening gap between the haves and the have-nots is not something that is going to be corrected by austerity. So it is extraordinarily unlikely that we're going to move back into austerity until there is clear and substantial evidence of inflation. And we are just not there yet. We do, however, know where all of this is going to end when we think about the fact that interest rates are already at zero and 2-year yields in the USA today move to a new low. Then when we think about the entire German yield curve is in negative territory. Japan's interest rates have been negative for a long time. I think it's worth just taking a look at lots of different interest rates. So for example, 2 years are down to 13 basis points, and the 30-year is down to 1.32% in the USA. Now, in the UK, those comparative figures are that the 2-year is now with a negative yield, and the 50-year is trading at 34 basis points. Now, that is quite unusual to have the 30-year trading at 54 and the 50-year at 34 is rather strange, but the 3 years at 1 basis point, the 5 years at 6. It's quite likely that the UK yield curve is now going to start to move into negative territory in a more profound manner and potentially look more like what we have in Europe, where in Germany everything has got a negative yield. But France hasn't been able to balance its budget in donkey's years, and they have still got negative yields going out to 10-year maturities, and even a 50-year is only 79 basis points. So this is going to raise some important questions. When we then think about where is it that a yield-hungry investor can secure a positive yield on a fixed income instrument with a reasonable rating? Well, either they're going to have to go out the risk curve. They're either going to have to go for longer dated securities. So you can still get a positive return in Canada, and you can get a positive return in Australia. And you still have yields there that are in excess of 1%. But even here, the 30-year in Australia is only 30 basis points higher than the 30-year in the USA. And commodity-related currencies tend to be much more volatile. and the Australian dollar has been trending down now for approximately 10 years. And it has now unwound its oversold condition relative to the trend mean. There is potential that it will be able to sustain a move back above it. And it's potentially likely that that will be the case, because Australia is one of the few countries where the coronavirus has been relatively well contained. They have got a reliance on commodities, but one thing that is almost certain is that there is going to be a commodity boom going into a massive infrastructure development spending spree globally to try and reignite global growth. And with positive interest rates, then Australia could start to attract significant inflows, which could push up the Australian dollar. This is something that I think is really worth monitoring, that when we're in an extraordinarily low interest rate environment, then competition is going to rise for assets that have a positive return. That's particularly true, for example, for life insurance companies. They have to match their forward liabilities and try and net off the deteriorating outlook for their premiums from inflation. And the only way they can do that is matching it off with bonds and creating a ladder. Well, you can only create a bond ladder if you have got positive interest rates. If you're holding to maturity and buying bonds with a negative yield, then it makes an absolute nonsense of the situation. When we look at Aussie dollar yen, then the yen has been trending higher against the Australian dollar in a pretty consistent manner for about 3 years, but it accelerated in a really profound fashion over the period of acute selling in March. Now it's come back to test the region of the trend mean. The big question from a lot of those Japanese insurers' perspective will be whether the Australian dollar can sustain a move back below the trend mean. Because when we go back and look at more history, there have been significant periods when the Australian dollar trended higher, or when the yen trended lower against the Australian dollar. The reason that I think it's worth keeping an eye on some of these commodity-related currencies in the short term is multifaceted. On the one hand, we have got metals like copper, which continues to rebound. It's found support in the region of about the $2 level, and that represented a low from back in 2016 as well. Now, it still has this overextension relative to the trend mean, but there is the clear potential that the low around $2 is going to hold. Then when we look at the nickel price, well, I think it is quite likely that we've seen the low for nickel. It has rallied over the course of the last couple of days, and it was up in a dynamic manner yesterday. It has not quite yet broken the downtrend from the peak back in September of last year, but it is potentially going to do that next week. And there is obviously the scope that whatever we see in terms of the energy sector going forward, that there's going to be increasing demand for batteries. In fact, the only way to really tackle the intermittency of sun or from solar and from wind is with storage solutions. And the most expedient of those right now is batteries, because the vast majority of available resources from hydro as a storage capacity for energy have already been exploited. And it also represents a rather heavy use of fresh water resources, and there is likely to be increasing competition for those going forward. Therefore, a battery-based solution is quite likely to be something that is going to attract additional interest. We've already seen something like that from Tesla. They produced the biggest battery in the world for South Australia almost 2 years ago, And they're now building, in fact, the largest battery in the world for one of the Hawaiian Islands. So that use of batteries to block out the intermittency of wind and solar is a really significant development. It is also going to remove the need for backup power in the form of coal. That doesn't mean that we're going to see the end of natural gas-fired power stations, but certainly it could represent a significant deterioration in demand for coal. So nickel prices are on the cusp of breaking upwards. Then when we look at the zinc price, or tin for that matter, they haven't quite broken their downtrends yet, but they have pulled back sufficiently that it is a realizable potential that we have seen the lows in the industrial metal complex. When we think about the continuous commodity index, then it has also pulled back in a really quite acute fashion, and it came all the way back down to test the lows from around 2008. There's still an oversold condition. It could rally significantly from here and still only get back up towards the 400-point level. But when we think about what are the potential scenarios, we know that there is a large quantity of infrastructure is aging. A lot of the roads that were built after the Second World War, the power plants that were built in the decades after the Second World War, are reaching the end of their useful lives. Not only are they seeing increasing demand for either traffic or production, but they were never built to take that kind of load. There is obviously a clear need to replace them, and that is something that stimulus could certainly help to pay for. Now, the one thing that I think most people are hung up on is how on earth all of this is going to be paid for. If we can get past the fact that there is just no way that governments are going to get voted into power on the basis of meeting their debts. So I think factually, or for all intents and purposes, we can just go forward on the assumption that the massive amount of debt that's been taken on over the course of just the last 2 months, on top of everything that's been taken on in the last decade, is not going to get paid back. And instead, governments and central banks are fully intent on completely eroding the total with inflation. And they are going to keep printing money. That is, I think, one of the biggest factors we can see now with the yield curve spread. It was arguable whether this inversion of the 10-year and 2-year spread was enough to signal a recession, but the fact that it has now broken up following the inversion tells us there's definitely going to be a recession, and realistically, we're already in it. During a recession, the most likely path for that spread is to surge higher. And in fact, that is what we have seen following every other inversion over the course of the last 40 years. On this occasion, we are probably going to see something that is more akin to what we saw in the period after 1981, in that we're going to have a lot more variability because the Federal Reserve is now clearly attempting to manipulate both ends of the curve. They do not want yields to rise in any way, shape, or form. There is the potential that the U.S. yield curve is going to start moving to an inverted position. Interest rates are already at zero, and there's the scope for yields to continue to trend downwards. The only way we're going to see yields trending upwards is if we get inflationary pressures starting to rise. That's not apparent in the short term, but it could potentially start to occur later. We know that the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the ECB, are going to keep producing additional currency in order to tackle the massive contraction in economies as a result of the lockdowns. Didi's, which is the Chinese version of Uber, their CEO was quoted in here today saying that their ride-hailing service is now at about 70% of where it was before the lockdowns. And that was being hailed as a real success. But that also means that there's been a 30% haircut in the size of their business. Now, that alone is comparable to the worst part of the contraction in 2008. And the hit to confidence is such that I think a lot of people are going to be rather cautious about taking Ubers or taking Lyfts in the short term. So they're also going to be cautious about taking public transport. New York shut down their entire subway network in here today to do a deep cleaning in advance of opening up again. To think that traffic volumes on the subway are going to be 70% of where they were in January within the space of a month, I think is a big ask. Maybe I'll be surprised. Maybe things will come back a lot faster. But I think that is a realizable target. What it suggests is there's going to be a massive source of additional liquidity. And that is a global phenomenon. There is the clear intention by just about all central banks to print money. And some countries can afford it better than others. And how much debt you have denominated in your own currency is obviously going to be a determinant of how easily it is to do that. But if you're issuing debt in the currency of somebody else's country, then you're in trouble. And the Brazilian real continues to trend downwards. And this is a clearly accelerating trend. There is a sharp contraction going on in the outlook for Brazil. Generally speaking, when the Brazilian real starts to deteriorate, that puts pressure on coffee prices. Coffee is right in the region of the lower side of the range that's been forming over the course of the last year. But there's this rounding characteristic overall. So there's potential for commodity price inflation. With the oil price looking increasingly likely that it has bottomed, then that should act as a support for corn prices. And corn has also pulled back to the lows over the last 6 years. It's a natural area where we might anticipate some support coming back in. Wheat prices have bounced from around the $5 area. And again, this is another chart where we have a clear succession of higher reaction lows within the 6-year base formation. This kind of rounding characteristic in a 6-year base is very reminiscent of the kind of pattern we had in gold before it successfully broke on the upside. So I do think that we have to be at least giving some credence to the potential that we are going to see commodity price inflation appearing in the not so distant future. Now, why might that be occurring? Well, we know that there are going to be bottlenecks in the global supply of food. And there are also going to be bottlenecks in the supply of industrial resources. We already know that there is a bottleneck in the oil market because we have got a dearth of storage. Now, Brent crude prices are currently trading in the region of about $30. They were in negative territory in here today. It has not yet been able to break the succession of lower rally highs. But it's quite likely that the lows around $20 are going to be the lower side of a long-term secular range. And the upper side of that range is probably going to be around $60. I think that what we are potentially seeing now in oil is similar to what we've been seeing in natural gas for most of the last decade, that we've seen a spectacularly volatile range forming. But that is at a fraction of the prices that prevailed before the crash in 2008. And I do think that that is what is likely to evolve from the oil sector. There is greater competition for the primary use of oil, which is for transportation, from electric vehicles, from hydrogen fuel cells. In fact, I saw news in here this week that we've seen another innovation in the creation of artificial or of cells that can produce hydrogen from photosynthesis. And using solar and a catalyst, they can turn water into hydrogen with no additional inputs from fossil fuels. Now, at the moment, the vast majority of hydrogen is being produced from natural gas. But as this technology improves, then there's the clear potential that we're going to have a hydrogen-based economy. And that is something that is also going to represent a storage facility for both wind and solar. And the cost of wind, the cost of solar continues to contract on a per watt basis. What it also means is that we're going to have a massive infrastructure build in terms of the energy sector. And all of that is likely to be funded with stimulus dollars, stimulus yen, and stimulus euros. So we are likely to see a massive increase in the quantity of money being printed to stimulate the global economy. And obviously, the one thing that people are very worried about is that we're going to have an additional leg lower because of a second bigger spike in coronavirus infections. I'm personally really skeptical of that conclusion because, on the one hand, we are much more prepared on this occasion than they were back in 1918. We are not coming towards the end of a world war, so the resources of each country can be fully devoted to overcoming the challenge from the outbreak. And additionally, the pace of technological innovation is increasing at a very rapid rate. And the biotech sector has been ranging for 5 years. It looks very likely that it is going to pop on the upside. So when we start to think then about what is it we can anticipate from the next few years, on the one hand, we can anticipate there's going to be a vast quantity of money printed. And that is going to have, on the one side, it's going to debase fiat currencies. So the other way of thinking about that is that the purchasing power of currency is going to deteriorate, which means that the nominal price of everything is going to rise. That is most acutely evident in the gold price. And gold was up $30 in here today, closing back above the $1,700 area. But that is really only half the story, because gold is now appreciating in every currency. And as a monetary metal, then the times when gold is appreciating in every currency, what it is really a sign of is that we are in a competitive devaluation environment. And for anyone who is trying to preserve the purchasing power of the money in their pockets, then there is obviously going to be an incentive to park it in something that can hold its value. The one important point about gold is that it is universally fungible. Gold in one country is still gold when you move it to another country. There is the other point, of course, about gold is that it's nobody else's liability. So there's no debt involved in the valuation of gold. But the fact that it is trending higher, and most particularly that we have got consistent trends on the upside for gold in a range of currencies, this tells us that we are now at a phase that is rather rare in terms of how often this occurs in a decade, but that there are very few times when gold tends to be the best performing currency in the world. It's representative of a time when people really do lose faith in the purchasing power of currencies. They also have the potential to start to lose faith in income-producing securities when the currency that they're denominated in is devaluing faster than the interest rate that one is receiving. When, for example, a bond yields 10%, in order to obviate that 10% yield, then the currency would have to go down by 10% in the space of a year. But when the bond yields 0.03%, or 3 basis points, a 3% devaluation in the currency completely erodes at your return on that investment. And when the yield is negative and you're buying those bonds, then any kind of currency devaluation at all is going to have a profound effect, because you're not going to get back par. So then this is obviously a challenge. The reason that Japan has been able to contend with extraordinarily low interest rates for such a profoundly long period of time is because there was positive interest rates everywhere else. So they were able to evolve to engage in a carry trade. They still had positive exports and a capital account that was positive, and a lot of that additional money was invested in higher yielding assets overseas. So then that insulated Japan from the threat from negative interest rates. But when we see an increasingly large number of countries going down this route, where the entire German yield curve is negative, then therefore Japan can't invest in Europe, and most of the people looking for a positive return in Europe can't invest there either, then they start moving money overseas. Now, the economic contraction that we're seeing in the USA, then that does raise the question, considering the demand for bonds that the Federal Reserve has as a result of its quantitative easing program, which is likely to continue to increase, then that represents a downward pressure on yields. So what happens when the USA moves to zero yields, the UK moves to zero yields, and then that puts downward pressure on yields in Australia and Canada? Where is it that an investor can invest in investment grade bonds and hope to get a positive return? Well, they can either go to the corporate bond market, they can go to some of the commodity producers, they can go to some of the better capitalized emerging markets, or they can desert the market entirely and start to look at other assets. One thing that we certainly have right now is that the yield on the S&P 500 is trading at still a very wide premium to what is available on the 10-year Treasury. There is 145 basis points of pickup between bond yields and equity yields right now. Now, historically, when we've been at the other side of this range, where there has been a 1.5% pickup for bonds over equities, then it has represented a challenge for equities to perform. But in the near term, there is clear potential for equities to continue to benefit. The one attractive quality for equities over bonds is that companies can increase their dividends. Now, that's obviously a challenge in an environment where vast swathes of the economy are in really dire straits. There are going to be companies that miss dividends, and there are going to be those that really can't keep up with the pace of their dividend increases. But the S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats have been raising dividends for 25 consecutive years, and there is a clear potential that it is these kinds of companies are going to be able to sustain their dividends growth. And it's dividend growth is where the real rubber meets the road in terms of insulation from inflationary pressures. Because we need to have something that can increase its payout faster than the rate of inflation. And of course, this isn't something that people are worried about in the short term. When we think about the short term, it's all about how big is the economic contraction going to be in the second quarter, and how much better is it going to be in the third quarter. But we have to start thinking about what the longer term consequences are of printing money with abandon, because eventually the buck has to stop somewhere. And one thing that we certainly know is that there are millions of people who are currently unemployed and making more money than if they were working. That's opening the door to significant moral hazard. When the government says that you are worth more idle than you are working, then that diminishes the value of work. And it is something that is going to create a problem. Because in order to get people back to work, either you have to cut their benefits, which is an extraordinarily unpopular move for any politician, and particularly so in an election year. Alternatively, then companies are going to have to pay more money. And if they're going to have to pay more money, then ultimately they either need to massively improve their productivity, which would mean hiring fewer workers, or they are going to have to raise their margins, which would mean raising prices. And companies raising prices and workers demanding more money, that's a recipe for inflationary pressures. I personally think that it's likely we're going to have additional upside in the stock market. I do not believe it is likely we're going to have a second larger incidence of coronavirus in the second half of this year. I think enough has been done to forestall that risk. But the issue is that we are now in a phase of massive monetary devaluation, and that inflates the price of everything. So that's why we've had a significant ramp in asset prices right now. Now, one thing that I do think is should be a note of caution in the short term is that, and I should go back to local currencies when we stray away from gold, but the NASDAQ is now in positive territory for the year, and it is rallying back up towards this 10,000 level. Personally, I think it is a bit of an ask to think that it is going to surmount the 10,000 level before having a meaningful consolidation. And the NASDAQ has been the best performing index of any index globally. And that is clearly the case. Now, when we look at the Russell 2000, then we have the opposite condition. It has pulled back in an extremely dramatic fashion. It has encountered resistance around the lower side of the overhead top formation and the minimum requirement to signal that we're back in a demand-dominated environment will be a sustained move back above the 1400 level. Then when we look at where the epicenter of risk is, which is the transportation sector, well, then we have a similar condition. that we had this type 3 top formation, where we had the loss of momentum, failed upside break, massive reaction against the prevailing trend in 2018, extremely impressive rebound, failure to move back above the 11,000 level on any sustained basis, and then another massive reaction against the prevailing trend. Now, the one thing I'm particularly alert to is that the 200-day moving average appears to be quite likely to pull back below the 1,000-day moving average. The size of the pullback we've seen is profoundly large, and I think it's worth going back and looking at other significant peaks, because back in 2006 and 7 we had a significant loss of momentum, big decline, massive reaction against the prevailing trend. Later, the 200-day moving average then started to accelerate down and through the 1,000-day moving average. When we go back and look at the period in the year 2000, we'd had extreme volatility in 1998 and 1999. What we can also think about is that the transportation index has generally peaked well in advance of the rest of the market, and it does not sustain moves below the 200-day moving average, does not drop back below the 1,000-day moving average during secular bull markets. And that is equally true of these two indices, whether that is the industrials or the transportation index or the S&P 500. It is generally the case that when the 1-year moving average falls down below the 5-year moving average, then we're in a bear market that lasts more than a few months, but potentially even a few years. So I think this is something that we need to be aware of, that there are growing challenges for the wider market. When we think about the S&P 500, then it is now coming back up towards the 200-day moving average, and it has, at least so far, sustained the move above the 1,000-day moving average. In the most benign scenario, it finds support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and then sustains a move back above the 200-day moving average. Then that would be clear, and a really clear indication that the lows are in. I think it is still quite likely that we have seen the lows, and that the low in March is not going to be exceeded. When we adjust the S&P 500 for purchasing power parity, then we can see that it got all the way back down to the lower side, the upper side of the underlying trading range in March, and has subsequently rebounded in a pretty dynamic manner. It has ample scope in which to consolidate and still hold this range overall. But we are probably in for at least some volatility over the course of the next month, because when a market rallies like it has, then there are lots of people that are worried about an additional problem arising later. There's a lot of people are worried about the fact that lockdowns are being ended perhaps too early. That gives a lot of people an incentive to take some profits at current levels. So in the short term, there is the clear potential that we are due a consolidation. There are certainly going to be other markets, potentially, or particularly the weaker markets, whether that is in the emerging markets like Brazil or Turkey or South Africa, where there is a significant internal problem, also a surfeit of debt that's been denominated in US dollars rather than domestic currency, and then the loss of export potential and a recession overall, then those markets are unlikely to be the ones that lead us up and out of this problem. When we think about what are the ones that are going to lead us, well, we already have the answers, and confirmation will be when they find support above their respective lows. The NYSE FANG index is representative of the companies that have done best from extremely low interest rates and abundant access to liquidity. That's been the case for most of the last decade. But it is still overbought in the short term. So we are due some consolidation. And the increasing prevalence of retail investors in the market, I personally find to be rather unsettling. When every institutional investor is expressing caution about the significant rally we've seen in markets, and retail investors are falling over themselves to buy the dip, well, that is usually the opposite of what we see at market bottoms. So I think that we are due consolidation. We are due at least some pullback in order to flesh out some of the risk trade right now. It's then how well we see lows form above the lows, or we get a higher reaction low. Let's be a little bit more correct. That will confirm the instruments that are most likely to lead, and will provide the next attractive buying opportunity. Well, the other sector that is really doing rather well right now are gold shares. And it is here that we have evidence of recent base formation completion. So gold shares were up again in a dynamic manner in here today. They have rebounded in extremely dynamic fashion off the lows in March, and are at a new recovery high in here. The majority of the established gold miners have got all-in sustaining costs significantly below where the prevailing gold price is, and the contraction in oil prices further bolsters their margins. Well, gold shares tend to be a really successful high beta play on gold prices, as long as they're not spending all their money on exploration. And so far that they're still in a capital constrained environment where they're not being offered the money to go out and build new greenfield sites. It's usually at this stage of the cycle where gold prices are really only just starting to advance that gold shares do best. By the time they have got some competition in terms of boosting supply and they start spending more money on building new mines, then its ETFs are generally the best way to play the gold price. But in the early stages, like now, its gold shares generally tend to do best. And not least when a number like, for example, Newmont are linking the size of their dividend to the gold price, well, then you're getting a return on your investment as well as leverage to the gold price, which is exactly what investors in gold shares are really looking for. Of course, the other side of that equation is that when interest rates are negative and the majority of bonds around the world have got negative yields, well, that is just bolstering the outlook for the gold price. The number of bonds that have got a negative yield contracted substantially over the last 6 months. And part of the reason for that was the significant move in peripheral debt in Europe. So I've spent some time at least thinking about what are the sectors that are most likely to benefit from the evolution of monetary financing. And we are clearly in a modern monetary theory environment where, and that's really not modern, there has been a relationship between decisions made in government and central banks forever. But then we had the period in the 1970s of debt monetization that ended in inflation. And I think that that is exactly what we're going to have on this occasion. Everyone is worried about how are central banks going to pay back the money. But the reality is they're just not going to. They're going to keep printing money to pay their debts. And they are actively now pursuing inflation. And this helicopter money environment, where politicians literally buy the good favor of the electorate, is something that is eventually going to end in tears. But perhaps not for a while. The place where we are probably going to have the most acute issue is in Europe. When we look at Italian spreads, the ECB has said that they have got every tool imaginable to tackle the upward pressure that we're seeing on spreads of peripheral debt over bunds. All of the German yield curve is negative, but spreads over bunds for Italy, for Spain, for Portugal, they are all rising. And this is a clear break of the downtrend. There is a clear need for the ECB to not only, better way to put it is that there's a clear need for the ECB to take a leaf out of the Federal Reserve's book and go for active yield curve management. And that means not giving the money directly to banks. It means ensuring that the yield curve spread does not expand. The upshot of quantitative easing was to inflate asset prices, but it did not help living standards to increase, and therefore was a failure, because it did not get the lending and borrowing engine back working again. The only way to do that is going to be direct payments to consumers. In other words, to completely circumvent the banking sector. But in order to achieve that, then they're going to have to do it in the periphery. And there is no appetite for that. When we think about the German Constitutional Court, the public sentiment in Germany towards bailing out what are considered to be profligate governments in the periphery is basically at zero. Now, the German Constitutional Court can say all at once about what's legal or not in Germany, but the ECB is responsible to the European Parliament, and it is governed by the European Court of Justice. In other words, what they do or say in Germany means absolutely nothing to the ECB. And when that fact is made abundantly clear to the German population, there is obviously going to be some unrest. The fact that the ECB is across the street from the Bundesbank in Frankfurt means in fact nothing. What it in fact means is that the ECB is a parasite and that it is sitting in the heart of the German financial sector, and that German treasure is going to be siphoned out of the country and made available directly to the governments of peripheral nations, who will circumvent their banking sectors and make it directly available to their populations. Now, that is not necessarily what could happen. It's the thing that needs to happen if Europe is going to try and get over its debt problem. What is more likely to happen is that there's going to be a fudge, and that the ECB will continue to buy bonds. But what they're doing right now, which is supplying banks with additional liquidity, is not working, because banks are not lending the money to their respective governments. Banks that are getting money from the ECB in France or Italy or Spain or Portugal are not buying French, Portuguese or Spanish bonds. They're buying bunds. And that is completely contrary to the ambition of the entire program in the first place. What it therefore suggests is that we are now at the end of Eurozone austerity, and that fiscal deficits in Europe are going to be the order of the day, and that it's going to be justified on a needs must basis, with the aspiration that the cohesion of debt to GDP ratios will be pursued again at some point in future. At some point, we're going to get to a denouement for the Eurozone, where they are going to have to decide about what to do about all the debt. When the owners of the debt are in Northern Europe and the sellers of the debt are in Southern Europe, there is unlikely to be a war. The kinds of countries that go to war on this kind of basis generally tend to have large young populations, and that is just not the case in Europe. So there is going to be a significant monetization of the debt. And that's not something that European investors are prepared for. What they are much more, and there is the additional point that the kinds of companies that tend to do well from a liquidity-rich environment have primarily been organically grown in the USA rather than Europe. So then we're either going to have an evolution of those kinds of companies willing to take risks on the basis that capturing market share with zero-cost capital is preferable to extinction. And even if it eventually ends in extinction, they will subsequently have become so large that they'll get bailed out. That's the business strategy that has worked best over the last decade, and it remains to be seen whether there will be sufficient interest in that kind of business model evolving in Europe. But it means that there is a brewing crisis in Europe, because government bond yields are rising, and the measures undertaken by the ECB so far are either inconsequential or they're just not big enough. And perhaps even more, I think, accurately, the practice of giving money to banks is only boosting the outlook for German borrowing costs. The practice of allocating bond purchases based upon the size of the respective economies is also benefiting Germany. So what they need to, in fact, do is reverse order. What Europe needs to do is to inverse weight the size of the assistance relative to the size of the economy. In other words, give more assistance to the smaller economies. Give more assistance to the countries that have got more debt. And then also to help the respective governments to run significant fiscal deficits and print as much currency as they require in order to stimulate their domestic economies. Now, unfortunately, that is going to come up against massive political resistance, and it means that Europe is going to be an extraordinarily difficult place to invest for the foreseeable future. And it could conceivably result in the end of the Eurozone project. If countries do not continue to progress towards cohesion and set up transfer mechanisms between the strong and the weak, then the outlook for the integrity of the currency system is really questionable. It means that investing in Europe is going to be extraordinarily difficult. It also highlights why leaving the EU was probably the best thing that the UK could do. It doesn't mean that the UK is going to be immune from challenges, and there has certainly been a mismanaging of the threat from the coronavirus. What they have clearly demonstrated is a complete inability to understand the implications of an exponential growth curve. Anyone who is familiar with technology knows what an exponential growth curve is. And the sooner you take action, then you have exponentially better outcomes. I think at this stage, everybody understands what the implications of acting quickly on an exponential curve are. It's a very difficult lesson to learn. But the UK does have an independent currency, an independent economy, and an independent judiciary, and an independent parliament, which is something that none of the other countries in the Eurozone have. And that is something that can really change the outlook for the economy. And I think it is particularly relevant that when we look at the yield differentials that we have on stocks in the UK, then we've got a significant pickup. The UK stock market yields substantially more than either domestic or regional bonds. And then the question is, how stable is the currency going to be? Well, we have seen over the course of the last 2 days that some resistance is being encountered in the region of the 200-day moving average. But the big question then is, are the lows going to hold? And I think that that is quite likely. The fact that the UK has got ultimate freedom to create regulatory arbitrage, to create currency arbitrage, to create competitive arbitrage between itself and other countries, then that does offer the clear potential to come out of this crisis in a stronger position. But all of those opportunities are going to have to be taken. When we look at what the ultimate aim is, well, we know that ultimately there is going to be a massive quantity of debt produced. And when we get to a point where interest rates everywhere are at zero, it's then that things start to get interesting from a debt perspective, because the ability to make a positive return from debt becomes extremely difficult. And then we have to think about the fact that geopolitical tensions are already rising. China has got clear long-term ambitions to become the global hegemon. And they are building a blue water navy. They are developing hypersonic missiles. They have already been able to shoot down satellites, and they've put their own rover. They already have their own space station, and they have put a rover on the dark side of the moon. So they are increasingly technologically adept. Eventually, there is likely to be a war. We already see that ambivalence towards China, and particularly their attitude towards releasing information about the coronavirus in a timely manner, is creating tension. The Belt and Road Initiative had already been creating tension, and the increasing assertiveness of the administration, the global ambitions of the domestic propaganda engine, all of these factors are aiming at creating a global footprint for China, and eventually that is going to create some opposition. And then there is the potential that we're going to have a war. And if the First World War and the Second World War are any example, it's the winners of the war set the rules. It's also the winners of the war get to take home the treasure, which in today's world is more about setting the rules and ensuring a preferential trading potential from the resulting framework. The losers of the war see their currency devalued to zero. And that is what is up for play. That is the ultimate way that this bond problem and this debt issue is eventually going to be resolved. It's likely there's going to be a nuclear solution. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to have nuclear war, but we have seen that the pace of technological innovation has accelerated spectacularly over the last 70 years. The first hypersonic plane is more than 70 years old. We have seen that every time there is a flare-up in geopolitical tensions, that the number of news stories about UFOs proliferates. At the same time, we know that China is actively developing hypersonic missiles. And then we also know that if there were hypersonic planes 75 years ago, then the pace of innovation over that time has to have come up with something better. The one thing that has been playing on my mind for 30 years was, why on earth would the USA bring their stealth fighters to the war in the Middle East? There was absolutely no need to reveal them to the world during the Gulf War. They were already highly streets ahead technologically of Saddam Hussein. Well, the only reason that a country would reveal their secret, and this was just after the Cold War, was in the sure knowledge that it was a technological lead that they wanted to show off to the world, but that it was already obsolete. So we have to think that there are technologies that we don't know about on all sides, and that they will become more strategically important as geopolitical tensions rise. The one thing that I think is a true game changer and would tip the balance either way is a reanimation of nuclear war theory. And the country that comes up with a method or weapon that would neutralize the nuclear weapons of their opposition has a clear incentive to capitalize upon it. So these are the kinds of considerations that we need to take into account from the long term. In the short term, I think it is likely we're going to get some consolidation, and potentially imminently. How well that changes are the outlook for recovery, and which sectors hold their breakouts or hold the regions of the 200-day moving average will be the clear indication of what leads us up in a recovery. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.